Mr. Nicoletti?
Yes. May it please the court, my name is John Nicoletti. I am a member of Nicoletti, Hornigan, Sweeney. Together with Mr. Goodyear of Jones Walker, we represent the appellant, American Commercial Lines, Inc. Because there are common interests with the vessel-owning interest of Tintamarro and DRD, the insured under the policy at issue, they have allotted their time to myself. So I will be taking 15 minutes for the direct argument and reserving five. This is a pretty simple, straightforward insurance matter insofar as whether or not this policy pays defense costs outside the limit. In our parlance, we refer to those types of policies as combined single limit policies, meaning that the amount to be paid under the policy for both claims and defense are combined into one. The key element of a combined single limit policy is whether or not that limitation or that restriction on the available monies for the insured are clearly defined within the terms and conditions of the policy. I'm not going to go through the cases because they are legion. Every case says this issue stands on its own and is subject to the terms and conditions of the policy under review. For the most part, my argument will be based upon the policy terms, because that's how the court instructs us to do it. This type of policy, which is really a joint policy, including both hull and machinery coverages, which are the property side of the policy, and the protection indemnity side, which is the liability side, is a combination of printed forms, which have been in the industry for many, many years. But most importantly, this policy is augmented, supplemented, and at times superseded by the manuscript terms and conditions set forth in this policy. What is very interesting, and you must take note of, is that the collision liability afforded under this policy appears in both the pre-printed form, the SP-23, and in the manuscript form. It is our contention and position that the manuscript language should supersede anything to the contrary in the pre-printed form. One of the cardinal rules of interpreting an insurance contract, as this court well knows, is the policy must be read as a whole. And where terms are not clearly defined, that definition will be found in the usage within the terms and conditions of the policy language. At page 31 of 35 of this particular policy of insurance, the specific coverage for the incident in question, which is a collision between the DM-932, a barge owned by ACL carrying its cargo, being towed or pushed by DRD the tower, came into collision with the MV Tintamarro, which is owned and operated, according to the pleadings by Lauren Maritime or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates. It is a collision case, plain and simple, which resulted in a massive oil spill in the Mississippi River on July 23, 2008, and which to date has cost well over $80 million for cleanup and payment of claims. The interest in having the policy limit exclude defense costs will increase the amount of money payable by DRD's insurers to the indemnity side of this ledger, which, as I said, is $80 million in counting. If you look at the collision liability language, it states, if the vessel hereby insured shall come into a collision with any other vessel, craft, or structure, floating or otherwise, this policy responds for that liability. But the last sentence in that paragraph says, we, the underwriters, will pay the insured or the surety, which shall have paid, such proportion of such sum or sum so paid, provided always that our liability will not exceed the limit of liability afforded under this policy. Notice that within the insuring terms themselves, they're telling the insured, with regard to the amounts that you become liable for, we will pay no more than the limit of our liability, or in other words, the full limit of the insured values. What is most important when you're reading this particular form, clause B of the coverage says, B, and in cases where the liability of the vessel has been contested, or proceedings have been taken to limit liability with our consent in writing, we will also pay the costs which the insured shall thereby incur or be compelled to pay.
Is that subparagraph 14 you're talking about?
No, that is not. This is the preprinted form. I'm sorry, this is the manuscript form appearing at page 31 of 35.
So this is
to me, this is the paramount.
Record excerpt tab 5. Y'all have made this incredibly difficult to find what you're talking about. And so future reference would be helpful. Just get like one policy submitted once instead of everybody's little piece that they want us to look at. But anyway, here it is, tab 5, record excerpts. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You can see the way the policy is structured. In the insuring terms, the policy is clear. We'll pay the full limit for liability for claims. Under the subparagraph B, it says, we shall also pay. This is not a novel argument. This argument was made in the case of St. Paul versus Royal Insurance in New York over 15 years ago. And the court specifically stated, where you say we shall also pay, that is a clear statement that the policy pays for defense costs outside the limit. Now, this particular clause comes out of the American Institute Tug form, which they lifted for purposes of putting it in this particular policy. The terms and conditions are exactly the same in this policy as was stated in the St. Paul versus Royal case. Now, if you go to the limit of liability clause in the manuscript form, which appears at page 33 of 35, it says, is understood and agreed that the insurer's limit of liability shall not exceed $1 million each accident or occurrence, regardless of the number of vessels involved. It says limit of liability. The only place they speak of limit of liability is in the insuring term, which is on 31 of 35, subclause A. It is not in the defense clause, subpart B. The other rule of thumb when you do go for contract interpretation of insurance contracts, you look to see if the insurer knows how to limit its liability. Going back to the limit of liability clause on 33 of 35, it clearly states, it is understood and agreed, it clearly states in the second sentence, any applicable deductible amount to be included within the aggregate limit amount. This insurer, these underwriters, clearly understood that if they wanted something included in the limit of liability, they know how to state it, because they included in the limit of liability not only their liabilities for claims, but also their liability for the non-liability for deductible.
If the collision coverage doesn't apply here, how does that affect your argument? Because there's an argument that it doesn't apply here. So I don't want to get into whether or not it does, but if it doesn't, then how do you still win?
Okay, let's go to the SB 23 form. The SB 23 form has a series of items for which it pays. There are 14 in total, some of which are described as liabilities, others which are described as costs. The only limiting language which appears in the SB 23 is found on the last page, page 6 of the form, second to last line, right above attached to and forming part of, is the statement, liability hereunder is in respect of any one accident or occurrence is limited to the amount hereby insured. Nowhere in this clause does it speak of combining a single limit of indemnity payments and costs in that statement. In order to reach that conclusion, you have to first of all go to paragraph 4, subparagraph 14 of the form, which describes the cost to be paid, and then say those costs are part of the liabilities. But nowhere in the policy does it define it that way. So again, this drafter wasn't accurate in the way it described its policy. If we go to this court's case in Exxon versus St. Paul, that bench, that particular panel specifically said, if you want to limit your liability to one figure, to include both indemnity payments and cost of defense, you must specifically so state. They did not do that in the SP 23 form.
But I mean, typically when you have a duty to defend and a duty to pay, first of all, we don't have a duty to defend here. We have a duty to reimburse. And so in the typical sort of unlimited defense obligation, it's just a defense obligation. It doesn't say anything about subject to the limit here provided. So it's subject to, of course, there needs to be an arguable case of coverage or whatever, you know, the eight corners, la, 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 but there's nothing about it being limited. And here there is something about it being limited in Section 14.
Section 14 only states what they'll pay for.
It says subject to the further conditions and limitations, and then it has conditions and limitations, and one of them is the one you just read.
The one I read is liabilities here under. Nowhere in paragraph 14 do they describe costs as being a liability.
Is there anything else in that whole section? We all just keep showing us what 14 says, but in the one through however many it goes through, is there anything else in that section that is outside of the $1 million limit?
My opinion, no, Your Honor, because anything that says liability is covered by the limit of liability.
Of all the things that are enumerated, everything is within the liability coverage, the policy amount, except this one thing.
Well, let me express it this way. Any paragraph in the enumerated 14 paragraphs that start off with the term liability, those are what is being referred to at the end of the policy when it says liabilities here under. And if you look at the paragraphs, the only ones that do not start with the word liability is paragraph 10, paragraph 12, and paragraph 14. But some of those involve suing labor, some of those are not specifically defense costs.
If the collision clause had not been placed in this P&I coverage policy, what would your argument be?
Well, if the manuscripted collision terms were not placed within this policy, then I'd have to use the collision clause within the context of the SB-23, and I'd fall back to my secondary argument, which I just expressed to Judge Haynes, that the policy is not clear enough to grant a combined single limit for both defense costs and indemnity payments within the $1 million.
I thought you were pointing to the collision clause as generating ambiguity.
I'm not saying the ambiguity is created, if there is one, to the extent that there's a conflict between the manuscripted form and the pre-printed form. And in that case, you must go with the manuscripted form. If you look at the manuscripted form, it's clear that they were not limiting payment. They were not including payment of defense costs within the payment of claims because they're two different subparagraphs, A and B.
Okay, I don't want to cut you off, but were you planning to talk about the priority of claim?
Let me
just ask you something on the priority of claim because I just may not understand this direct action statute. If you were merely, you never claimed to be an additional insured. You were just merely alleged to be both a tortfeasor and a victim of a tort. Would you have the right under the Louisiana Direct Action Statute to recover your attorney's fees for defending against other people calling you a tortfeasor?
We are not seeking attorney's fees any longer.
Okay.
Once we discovered that we have been defrauded.
Cost of defense is gone.
That's
so
right.
I was really lost about how you get cost of defense under direct action.
We were never seeking that. We're seeking the same status as Tintamarro.
Okay, so you want to recover your own losses to your barge and all of that, and not what you might be held liable to somebody else for. Oh, you are asking for that, but not for your attorney's fees on that. And
that's correct.
Costs and your, you know, expert witness and all that. Just if you're held liable to Mr. X, then you want to be covered for what you have to pay them.
That's correct.
Plus damage to your barge and whatever.
That's correct.
All right.
Now, if I look at the maritime case, which I don't really agree with because of the way they mix and match other insurance clauses from policies issued to different insureds, which has never been the standard, the key point of maritime is they're trying to protect people from uninsured losses. Well, in regard to the Tintamarro and in regard to ACL, we're both insured. So we should be on the same footing. The only other claimant in this case is John Barbary, the steersman, who is the ultimate partial cause of this loss, the unlicensed helmsman. There are only three claimants left. Most importantly, all three claimants are in the DRD limitation action. And if that be the case, the limitation statute itself sets forth that it should be a pro rata sharing of all tortfeasors. And that's the key. That's the key point we're arguing against the district court's decision, is that he applied an equity standard instead of the statutory standard as expressed in the Limitation Act. And if you're going to do an equity standard, maritime itself is equity, and there's sufficient rules in maritime under where you have tort claimants that they all share pro rata. So that's what we're arguing in regards to the district court's decision's mistake. He should have applied federal maritime. And if you're going to put us on all equal footing, we're all on the same footing insofar as Tintamarro and ACL. And most importantly, I want to bring this to the court's attention, ACL is an uninsured for almost $2 million. $850,000 in deductibles, which it paid out of its pocket, and $1.2 million for a cargo loss that was uninsured. So they should have priority, at least as an uninsured to that extent. Thank you.
Mr. Lawton?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm David Lawton. I represent Lauren Maritime and the other Tintamarro interest. I think the question that was put forth a few minutes ago is the one that's important to this case in terms of procedural posture. This ruling by the judge came forth as a result of a motion by ACL to get paid over $600,000 of attorney's fees from the million-dollar interpleader. That would have depleted a very substantial amount of that interpleader fund, and to which we objected. And the judge ruled. He ruled with respect to claims for Siemens claims, for DRD's attorney's fees, and for ACL's attorney's fees. And he rejected that claim. Now, that ruling came, and there was never at that time any claim by ACL that they could void their contract with DRD ab initio. They were claiming as additional assured. And that was the posture of the case, of the motion that was before the judge and when it was appealed.
So you're saying the judge has never ruled on this whole direct action argument. I mean, it was there in the pleadings, but it was never ruled on.
That's correct.
And so we would be jumping the gun to get in the middle of that.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that essentially this is either moot or not well taken. It shouldn't be reversed because he's not wrong. The judge wasn't wrong what he said because we think he was right. But in the context of what he was talking about, he was talking about attorney's fees. So, and that's
he's
not.
He just admitted it's not a direct action.
Exactly. So the judge hadn't considered this in the context of which they're arguing. That's our primary position here. If the court were to decide this, which we think is premature, he says, well, everybody should be on the same basis, maritime lien claimants. You know, on a limitation statute, we have a collision. We have a claim, a maritime lien against the vessel. They own the vessel. They can't have a lien against their own vessel. So we don't think, but that's never been briefed to the court. So these
okay, issues. So you're saying on the second point, the ordering of claims and all that, we should simply remand and say this status of ACL as direct action claimant was not previously adjudicated, and we should just remand for its adjudication.
Exactly. To be handled in the normal course of the trial. We have a trial set in August. I think it's premature on that in that regard. To handle that any further.
So no one cares what we think? You're just going to have the trial without us?
Well,
can
I think
we go home?
Well, I think it could be. I think the issues on attorney's fees, which we appealed as well, is a significant issue because it's the size of the DRD
But it
fund.
Doesn't have anything to do with what you're saying. You're saying you're trying the actual tort claims.
The
who
tort
did,
claims.
Who did wrong?
The collision case is being tried in August. It's set for trial in August. And so some of these things may become moot, or who knows what will happen with all that. So, in any event,
that's kind of important. I mean, while we always enjoy the opportunity to deal with complex insurance cases, I don't really want to be doing something that's unnecessary. So if there's some aspect of this y'all don't need our help on, please tell us that before we spend further time on it.
Well, I think the aspect that I'm here arguing about, my primary purpose is not to have something unanswered about what they said. I mean, frankly, we think that their argument was wrong. We think it wasn't presented to the judge. And if you were to decide that it was sufficiently presented and to rule upon it, then we still think the judge is correct. So I'm here really as a precautionary matter because I don't want a ruling where somebody says, well, you had your chance to say something, you didn't. We think the way the judge ruled is correct. We think it's equitable consideration. We think he did it properly. But I have to admit, that was not before the court. And I don't see why this court now, on that particular issue, mm-hmm. needs to make a decision. I don't think it should be reversed. I think it should just be said that for a 54B circumstance, this is not the proper time. Thank you very much.
Okay, on the eroding defense costs or not eroding defense costs issue, though, the who caused the collision and all of that doesn't have really anything to do with that. In other words, What?
Erode
well, how much might be held to pay for those claims out of insurance proceeds is not in any way related to who did wrong and how much harm did it cause. Or it's related, but you know what I'm saying. In other words, the insurance coverage question is not the same as the tort question.
That's correct. That's but DRD has, in criminal proceedings against us, admitted it was negligent. They were operating the vessel at the time. So there's not much question that their fund, which is $1 million in primary, which has already been paid out to Siemens claims and maintenance and cure and some attorney's fees for DRD's counsel, with no objection by anybody, that's gone. There's another $8.5 million left in the second round of interpleader, which you're going to be discussing. Now, if the attorney's fees do not deplete the policy, then you're going to have a greater amount that's to be distributed to all claimants. So the attorney's fees issue, the depletion or not, is an issue that's ripe for decision and will affect the overall. So our position on that is, yes, that should be decided. As respect to priority of claims, it wasn't presented to the court in the posture that it should have been.
Do you want to talk about the erosion issue?
The depletion issue?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
I'll adopt Mr. Nicoletti's argument with respect to the depletion of the. I don't think, and I yielded my time to him earlier.
Okay.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Sorry. Okay.
May it please the court. The case law in this case, for 50 years, has shown that every SP-23 P&I form, before and after the Exxon case, has been interpreted uniformly to show that attorney's fees are within limits. Similarly, the case laws we'll discuss with respect to the, quote, manuscript provisions has uniformly ruled that in the P&I context, the attorney's fees are within limits. The rule that our Judge Higginbotham provided in Coleman versus School Board of Richland, which is cited by ACL and cited by Mr. Nicoletti, is the correct rule that we have to give effect to every provision of the policy, so when it's read as a whole, we give effect to each one of those. Now let's look at the policy. Let's start with the fact that you've got hull coverage on standard forms, and you've got P&I on the SP-23. And then what DRD's broker did, so this is not a contra profferentum case against the insurance company. What DRD's broker did is they took the collision and towers out of the hull and they put it within the P&I. When they did that, they made it expressly subject to the SP-23. So I want to look briefly at the SP-23. The SP-23 starts with the insurance company's liabilities. Starts with the liabilities of the insurance company. And that's where Mr. Nicoletti is giving you an interpretation that's not quite correct, because he talks about, when it talks about liability at the end, what those liabilities are, they're 14 points, as you set out. There are 14 points that are set out, 14 different insurance company liabilities. The insurance company is liable for each one of those to reimburse the insured. 11 of those are liabilities of the insured, but 3 of them are not liabilities of the insured. We have to reimburse the insured even though they're not liable for those, like defense costs. They're not liable for defense costs. They don't have to incur defense costs, but they do. If they do incur those defense costs, then we're responsible, the insurance company, to reimburse them. That's a liability of the insurance company.
How does this law costs section on page 4, which is a tab 5 of the somebody's record excerpts, how does that factor into this whole analysis?
It factors in because the entire policy, and I'll go through the manuscript in just a minute, the entire policy, the entire P&I, where this is, taken out of hull and put in P&I, is made subject to the SP-23. And law costs are an express liability of the insurance company to reimburse those. We have to reimburse those law costs.
Well, because I'm interested because there's this argument about whether the word costs include attorney's fees, and here we have this term law costs, which seems to include attorney's fees.
It does.
Okay.
It does because it's the costs involved in defense against the insured's liabilities.
Okay.
And so if they incur a cost in defense of those, then we owe it. We don't dispute that the legal fees are covered under Section 14. We don't dispute that at all. They have been since the for 50 years. But for 50 years, because Section 14 says it is expressly subject to, as Your Honor pointed out, it's expressly subject to the limitations that follow. The limitations that follow have one that says the liability hereunder. So if the insurance company is liable, and it's liable for those fees, if the insurance company is liable, then the liability for one accident is the amount hereby insured.
Well, and I think this word liability, it seems to me here it's being used as the insurance company's liability to the insured,
yep.
Whereas in the other context it's the insured's liability to the third-party injured party.
Absolutely. Okay. That's the correct point, Your Honor, is that there are 14 points in here. 14 points. The insured is liable for 14 things, and we have to pay for those. There are three things.
Remind me of what's in 10 and 12.
I'm sorry?
Remind me of what's in subparagraphs 10 and 12.
I'm sorry.
Just remind me. Oh, I don't have it in front of me.
I've got it right here, Your Honor.
Just briefly, what's in 10 and 12? What's covered in 10 and 12?
Yeah, they're actually kind of cool things. What they are is expenses for resisting unfounded claims by the master crew in cases of mutiny or misconduct. So if there's a mutiny, even though they're not liable for defending against that and they incur costs, we have to reimburse them for those costs. And there is loss for deviation, which under the law, there's not liability in certain cases of deviation. If the insured deviates, we have to reimburse them for their losses in that case. Even though that's not a liability, it becomes a liability of the insurance company, and the insurance company has to pay for that.
Well, you have a liability of tortfeasor to claimant, which is what 1 through 14, except for 10, 12, and 14 are dealing with.
Yes.
And then you have liability of insurance carrier to tortfeasor, the insured, which is what the whole thing's dealing with.
Yes. And the last one, which is the law cost, is made expressly subject to the limitation. And then the limitation says that the liability of the insurer is limited to the policy limit. And that's why for 50 years the cases have said, like it started in New York, it's been followed in the federal courts, it's been followed in the state courts, it's been followed in the Louisiana courts, and it's been affirmed twice by this court, including one of them that I cited, the Taylor case. But here's what the case said in Ross. It said that this language, the last clause, this language plainly shows underwriters did not have an open-ended obligation to pay costs. They don't. And the district courts in this circuit have ruled the same, as I said, twice affirmed by the Fifth Circuit. The Taylor case is one. In the Taylor case, there was a $4 million excess policy on the SP-23, and the court ruled attorney's fees were properly deducted from the policy limits. The Exxon case, which is St. Paul and Exxon from this court, is a really interesting case because that case, aside from being unintelligible in the policy, the policy provisions are unintelligible to start with. It's hard to say what's covered. But what they did is in the limitation clause, they said they put the word costs in, but they didn't put fees in. And the court said when you do a limitation clause, if you put something in and you leave something out, then you're not going to get it under the contra preferentum rule. Absolutely. Could not agree with that more. If I could understand the clause in the first place, I would certainly agree with that. That's what the court said. And the court's right. The point in our case is it's completely different because what we did in Section 14 is we said, okay, we're going to pay the law costs. And that's subject to the limit, and then there's a straightforward limit. Under Judge Higginbotham's rules, he said, you have to give effect to each provision. So when you incorporate the limit into one, and the limit is straightforward, it's unequivocal, there's nothing left out, there's nothing, it's straightforward that anything, any liability we have as an insurance company from an incident is limited to the policy limit. Now, either we're liable for those costs or we're not. If we're not liable, fine. But if we're liable, we're subject to that limit. Now, the best part is the manuscript provisions are even clearer because the manuscript provisions begin and end by having the limitations. They begin by twice putting in the limitation. The first words are protection and indemnity according to the terms and conditions of the SP 23. And then it says this is separate insurance, always subject to the terms and conditions except for the hull where it was taken out of the hull. And then you've got the provisions of the liability and the attorney's fees, and then it follows right after that with a limitation that says it is understood and agreed the insurer's limit of liability shall not exceed $1 million each accident or occurrence. Not for just liability, but for the accident or occurrence. If it's a liability of the insurance company, it's $1 million for that occurrence. Straightforward. That's not ambiguous. There's nothing ambiguous about it. Using Judge Higginbotham's language, you give effect to the policy. This is repetitious to the point of redundancy. Three times is incorporation of the limitation. Now, the case law supports that interpretation completely. We cited the Marine Transit case from New York because it was affirmed by the Second Circuit. In that case, you had virtually identical collision and towards liability. There was a question, as Mr. Nicoletti points out, whether or not the limitation, the separate limitation, was in there. But the point the court ruled in New York is that this very language was subject to the policy limit, and the Second Circuit affirmed. And in affirming that, the Second Circuit said, didn't just affirm it, they reiterated that the liability, that the insurance company is liable to the amount of its policy. And that was it. But the best case is the case that they cited, and it's the best case to end with. And that's St. Paul versus Royal. And the reason that sums it up perfectly, because what happened in that is you had collision and towers, and it was left in the hull. And collision and towers in the hull is not subject to a policy limit, the attorney's fees. There's nothing in there that says it's subject to the policy limit. And that's the way those collision and towers in a hull coverage were written. When you take that and you pull it out and you put it in the P&I, it's different. And what happened in St. Paul and Royal is that the excess, that policy had both primary in the hull and it had excess subject to the SP 23. And the court ruled that for the part in the hull, the attorney's fees were outside limits. And with respect to the SP 23, the court said the attorney's fees were within limits. And the point of that, and here's what the court said, that there is no recovery for attorney's fees in this case from the excess portion of the policy. The point is, if you leave it in the hull, subject to limits, when you take it out and you thrice subject it to the policy limits, it is subject to a limit. INA, in good faith in this case, paid $1 million into the registry of the court. No one would like for this case to be more subject to hull rules than INA. The reason is we would pay nothing. The warranty of seaworthiness would bar any recovery. We argued that to the district court. We argued to the district court that there is a traditional warranty of seaworthiness for collision and towers in a hull policy. And Judge Afric correctly ruled in DE 558, he correctly ruled that when you take it out of the hull, it isn't a hull coverage anymore. It's a P&I coverage. And in P&I, I have to give him, P&I is not subject to the warranty of seaworthiness. That's exactly why the Royal St. Paul case is correct here. You leave it in the hull, attorney's fees are outside. You take it out and you put it in the P&I, subject to the SP 23, it's subject to limits. Three times in the policy, it's redundant to the point of redundancy. We paid that $1 million into the registry of the court. We humbly ask this court to affirm the district judge's decision that attorney's fees are within those limits. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Nicoletti?
Let me address the St. Paul versus Royal case first. I was the trial attorney for St. Paul. In that case, they actually did make the argument that under the Hull policy, it was a combined single limit, because in that form, there is a statement that says our liability is limited to the amount insured. So I don't know how his reference to my excess policy, which was the St. Paul, has anything to do with it, because most excess policies are combined single limit with their manuscripted terms. So putting that aside, that case still stands for the proposition. If you're going to have collision and towers liability, it's going to be outside the limit when you use those terms, unless you specifically state in the limitation clause that the attorney's fees are inclusive. Let me run through the various cases that he cited in support of his proposition. Ross is probably the easiest one because Ross did involve an SB 23, but it was endorsed with very specific combined single limit language. Turning to the Board of Commissioners versus Guidry. Again, that's an SB 38, much clearer than the SB 23. That specific limiting language states, liability hereunder in respect of loss, damage, cost, fees, expenses, or claims arising out of or in consequence of any one occurrence is limited to the amount of insurance herein. That's the SP 38. That is the special limiting language in the limitation of liability clause. You have no such clause in the manuscript portion of this policy for collision and towers liability. Collision and towers liability is not part of a Hull policy per se. They at one time put it in there. But once you take terms out of the Hull form, they become that part of any other policy you write, whether it be a marine excess, a bumper shoot policy with a drop down, or a protection and indemnity policy, which do not always take the form of one of the pre-printed, such as the SP 23, the SP 38, or the AMU 1983 forms. This is a manuscript policy. To the extent that there's any inconsistency between the manuscript and the printed form, the rules are the manuscript controls. Now, I understand that the appellee quoted from the introduction section of the policy. What he doesn't state is that there's nothing in the introduction which says contrary terms overrule the manuscript terms. It just says it's subject to. But that's only the introduction. You again have to read the policy as a whole. And if they didn't want the collision liability to be a standalone manuscripted coverage, if they wanted just collision liability, they could have just attached the SP 23, which does have collision liability, as one of the 14 enumerated items. So the fact that they made it a special coverage would indicate and represent that these underwriters wanted the collision liability to the extent it applies to this case, and I don't know why it wouldn't apply, that it would be a separate coverage outside of the pre-printed form and subject to its own limitation language. And again, the limitation language in the manuscripted form is generic at best. Now, Taylor is another interesting case which he cites. It's funny, Taylor was actually cited in Exxon and was not followed by the Exxon court. Again, if you look at the language in Taylor, the issue of combined single limit is a reference or dicta. It is not a holding of that court in the context of that case. As I indicated, Guidry is an SP 38 form case with very specific language, different from what's in the SP 23. Marine Trust, again, had its own separate limitation of liability language. It did not have, quote, liabilities insured hereunder. It had the following. It is further agreed that in no event shall this company be liable under this policy for more than the sum insured in any case by reason of any and all of the conditions of this policy.
Well, I thought Exxon involved a personal injury claim and not a collision.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I said, I thought Exxon involved a personal injury claim and not a collision.
I understand that, but Exxon stood for the proposition. If you, whether it is a personal injury claim or a property damage claim like collision, the rules are the same. You look at the policy to see to what extent the limitation of liability language includes defense costs. And our position is quite clear. If it doesn't include, if it doesn't so state.
But what that bears on is what do you do with the word also pay? And if you take it, if it's not a claim under the collision policy, then you have all, it makes a difference in the way you read the policy.
Well, both policies have the same language, shall have been liable for and shall have paid. I mean, if you look at the collision language, it has that same language as does the SP23. They're both, quote, indemnity policies, or what we call pay to be paid. So I don't see a distinction there, Your Honor. Any further questions?
Thank you. We have your argument. The court will take a brief recess before we hear the argument.